This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Teaching politics can be an interesting balancing act in the best of times. This year, well, who the heck knows?
I tend to try to keep the same approach regardless of how heated or not heated the election is.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a professor of politics about how exactly he gets his message across to students and how they get theirs right back to him. We'll also hear from a professor who is fascinated by the world of magic and magicians and thinks you should be too. And we'll spend an academic minute talking about how what you read influences what you write. I'm Bob Barrett. And this is The Best of Our Knowledge. I think we can agree that even the biggest political junkies among us have never seen an election season quite like this one. So if it's your job to teach politics, what do you do? Ignore it? Embrace it? Try to explain it? Or just wallow in the absurdity of it all? And then again, is it really all that absurd? We need a professional. And Dr. Adam Carrington is an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College in Michigan. We spoke to him a few weeks ago about the Constitution, but I wanted to get his take on teaching politics in a world that appears to have gone slightly mad. So first off, professor of politics, what does that entail? What exactly do you teach?
We really do define politics rather broadly, and I think that's helpful to do. We define politics as how human beings live in community with each other under law and under justice, and really define the idea that, you know, human beings are political animals, and that politics, talking about what's just and unjust, acting upon it through law, is really something that human beings can't help but doing. And so what we try to do is, through documents, through different times in history, through different questions, get at what it means to be a human that participates in questions of law and justice.
What type of student do you get, and what do they expect to get out of this class?
I think the type of student I tend to get is often twofold. There are those that are very, very interested in contemporary politics, that are very much wanting to know or wanting to talk about who's going to win the next election, what the policy debates are that are going on now. And I also get others, we're very much a liberal arts college, who are interested in the broader, bigger questions and interested in them in their sort of history about what is justice, what is liberty, what are rights, how should governments be constructed? And I get really both, and some that are interested in each one, and I try to be able to reach both of them where they are to try to get them to ask some of the more the bigger questions about human politics that I mentioned earlier.
It's interesting. Do you try to get the theory students to think about, you know, the contemporary and vice versa?
Absolutely. You try to meet students where they are and then stretch them beyond that point. And the way I do try to do that is I do try to bring in contemporary examples where they're helpful to show that the problems that people have been arguing about for thousands of years, the circumstances may change, but a lot of the essential debates change. And I try to also show that those that are very much interested in contemporary ideas, that this isn't the first time that's come up. It isn't the first time we've been arguing over who should rule and why, or what different concepts of human rights are. And I try to then pull them more toward looking at how does this fit into this broader historical discussion that's been going on since the ancient Greeks, if not before. So yeah, I try to take them where they are and then stretch them into areas that they may not be as used to.
It can almost be one of the purest forms of teaching history.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting to discuss the difference between history and politics, and to be honest, both are very much intertwined with each other. We are studying certain ideas, but we're studying them as they've played out in human history. And very much, you know, historians and my friends who are historians are often looking at some of the same issues we have, but from the perspective of how those events have played out. So I think, you know, that's where being at a liberal arts college has been helpful, that we've been able to talk between each other on how our different fields can shed light on similar issues.
When you get a year like this year, and I hate saying that because I think every presidential election we say, oh, this is the worst one yet, but this one just kind of feels different. When you get a year like this, do you try to teach more theory and ignore just all the noise, or do you just dive right into it?
I tend to try to keep the same approach regardless of how heated or not heated the election is. And what I try to do is say that as a teacher, I am looking more for the longer perspective. And so while I say that I bring in contemporary examples, I try to only bring them in the context of the broader point we're discussing. So we had a discussion in my presidency class recently about, should we repeal the 22nd Amendment and allow presidents to run as many times as they want? And of course, I brought up, well, would you want President Obama to run a third time? Would you have wanted Ronald Reagan to run a third time? But I then try to pull them back and say, no, the real question is, regardless of your partisan affiliation, what do you think is best for the country? What do you think is best for justice? And so what I try to do is not allow this classroom to become partisan cheerleading for either side. I try to say, I'll bring in contemporary examples and try to bring in balancing contemporary examples insofar as they illuminate the broader issues of the structure of government or the nature of justice that we're talking about.
And what do the students bring into this discussion? What do they add to the class?
They add a lot. It's actually a wonderful thing. I love working with my students here. And what they bring is a number of things. They bring an energy about the subject. They bring an inquisitiveness where they really want to push to know what the issues are and how to get deeper into these questions that we're discussing. And to be honest, they teach me often, especially some of the ones that have been with me for a while and taken several classes, where they will read a text and sometimes have an insight or a perspective that I didn't see. And so I always tell them, you know, we're all students. I'm a student, they're a student. I may be at a different point in the road than they are, but being able to interact with them in class, and I tend to have a very conversational style, really they teach each other, they teach me, and I think I'm able to teach them. And having that atmosphere is just a wonderful situation when it's going well.
What kind of student majors do they have?
The ones that are taking my class?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, it depends. I teach classes that are dedicated to the major, and those are mostly political science majors, or our department is called the Department of Politics. But also you'll have people from history or political economy that take classes there as well. I also, every semester, teach a U.S. Constitution course, which is a core requirement here at the college, and because of it, I have people from across all sorts of majors, people that are going to major in anything the college requires, because everyone has to take the class. And I actually enjoy both challenges. For the core class, there's more of the challenge of showing these students that studying politics matters. Why does it matter to them as a human being and a citizen? And for the majors, they're already keyed in. They're already open to it mattering, and to really showing them, therefore, getting them to question their assumptions, getting them to refine their assumptions, getting them to just get deeper into the subject matter.
We've spoken about the Constitution before. How much does the Supreme Court, how much is that in your teaching?
It's a lot, and some of it is just my own research and writing interests. A lot of what I do is in constitutional law. But I also have found studying case law, is helpful because typically in a well-written set of opinions, you have both sides of the argument laid out, I think, in a thoughtful way and in a good way. And so, you know, I do use case law even outside of my constitutional law cases, and I try to make sure I tell them it doesn't mean that I think that the Supreme Court is infallible or the only person that can pontificate on the Constitution. I don't. It's really to as a forum for people to be able to talk broader. But that said, yes, I use a lot of court cases in order to try to set up these arguments for the students to dive into.
You see a diverse group of students. Do we understand just what the Constitution really is?
That is a question that I think is a very good one. I mean, I think we really do need to ask about what is the role of a Constitution. And I'll point out one disagreement that has come up in my classes, which is the relationship between popular will, the will of the people, and the Constitution. To what degree does the Constitution merely provide a way for government to mirror the will of the people, and in what ways does the Constitution mitigate or limit the will of the people? And I think that a lot of people in the debates I've seen in my classes and elsewhere will tend to go hard one way or another. The Constitution is just a conduit for the people's desires, the people's will. Others will say, no, look at all the restrictions in the Bill of Rights elsewhere. It's meant to stop the people's will. And I think one thing we don't keep in proper balance is it's kind of both. It's ratified by the people as a way of restraining their temporary passions in the service of longer, more fundamental principles that they have and want. And I think having that kind of perspective then at least helps. It's necessary but not sufficient, but it at least helps in getting at some of the particular questions about this clause, this amendment, or those things that I think would help some of our political discourse.
If you have the Constitution, you know, go to the whims of the people, you end up with prohibition.
Yes, and then end up with the sort of strange, almost embarrassing need to repeal it, barely over a decade later. And I think that's where, you know, the difficulty of amending the Constitution actually guards it against that. And I think combined with something we talked about in a previous discussion, the necessity of only letting the Constitution cover what it covers, not trying to make it, as Tocqueville warned us might happen, reducing everything to a legal argument. I think allow the Constitution to do what it does, allow for the debate about it to be in that sphere, and actually you'll still see a lot of room for Americans to debate and disagree on particular policies within what the Constitution allows.
Well, what do you have planned going, you know, for the next 50 days or so up to November 8th? Is there anything you do differently in a year like this?
Well, I certainly have a lot more examples that I can bring in from outside. One thing I do try to make sure is that the debate, when we do bring up issues of the current election, that it's conducive and helpful to the class. Every once in a while you'll get moments where students are upset or passionate about something, and it doesn't happen a lot, but where you want to make sure that it doesn't reduce to name-calling or ad hominem. And like I said, I've very, very rarely seen that. The students have conducted themselves well. But just trying to make sure that everyone in the classroom feels that if they are arguing well and making their point well, that they will be respected in the classroom. And I haven't had a major problem with that, but you always want to be on your guard to be a devil's advocate and make sure that they've seen both sides of the arguments. And I think that's something I have to be particularly careful on during an election season. Other than that, I'll be paying close attention. I become, I'll just admit, a bit of a poll junkie, like a lot of Americans do. And so I'll try to bring that into the classroom, but also just as a student of politics myself, see what I can learn from this election season.
Well, for the love of God, keep them away from any cable news channels and you'll be doing fine.
Well, that's the thing. We say, and why I give them differing views, and I try to give them intelligent differing views, because it's not merely that there are different points of view, but there is higher and lower quality of how an argument gets made. And I really hope the classroom can be a forum where we learn not only to speak, but to speak in more enlightened and refined ways. And I hope that my classroom can be one conduit for that kind of discussion that I hope you know, whether my students are political science majors or anything else they do. I hope that, you know, it can be a forum where they can learn to be human beings and citizens together.
Dr. Adam Carrington is an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College in Michigan. Still to come, people have been performing magic for hundreds of years. Why does this still fascinate so many of us? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that unless you're reading one of the Harry Potter books, you haven't given much thought to magic lately. Dr. Jason Ledington wants to change that. He's a professor in the philosophy department at Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Ledington has written about magic for a few years now, calling it the art of the impossible. He says the lack of interest in studying magic is puzzling given its popularity over the years. We spoke about this recently, and I asked, why are we still so fascinated by magic?
One of the most interesting things about magic is that despite the fact that it's one of the most popular performing arts in the last 200 years in the West, art historians, art critics, and philosophers of art have basically ignored it completely. And that's a surprising fact when you consider how popular it's been. So one of the things I want to try to understand is, first of all, why has it been ignored? But also, and more importantly, why are we fascinated by it? And we can feel the force of that question, especially powerfully, if we think about, you know, the surprising fact that, like, though we know it's a trick, we're still interested in what goes on, and what goes on may in fact be deeply, deeply memorable. My idea is that, and I think that most magicians, when they hear this, actually agree with me, that the point of magic is not simply to fool us or to try to convince us that the magician has supernatural powers. The point of magic is to give us a kind of experience induced by a kind of illusion of impossibility. So the idea is that even though you know that what you're witnessing is a trick, you don't see how it could be. And that puts you in a really interesting position. It's an uncomfortable position. You know it's a trick, but you don't see how it could be. So that comes back to your question, why do we enjoy magic? Why are we fascinated by it? Why does anybody enjoy that experience of knowing something's a trick, but not seeing how it could be?
What was it about the topic that attracted you?
Well, I was initially attracted to magic because I loved the experience of magic. I loved watching good magic. And through most of my life, I had never really seen good magic. And I don't think actually most people really have. But it turned out that one of my mentors in graduate school was an excellent magician. I had no idea until one night he did a card trick for me that completely blew my mind. And it stuck with me to this day. I had another formative experience witnessing someone who turned out to be one of the great sleight-of-hand artists in the world performing on the streets of Paris, just sitting behind a table doing amazing card and coin tricks that left my stomach turning over on itself. So those were really the experiences that led me to have an interest in understanding what was going on in me and why I was enjoying that experience. And it turned out that when I looked to see what other people had written about this, there was really very little. Magicians have written about it for magicians, but philosophers of art and art critics and art historians haven't touched it at all. And psychologists really have barely touched it. Even though people have become interested in the neuroscience of magic and how we get fooled, very little work has been done on why we actually enjoy it.
It seems like it's the everyman's art form. I mean, there are a few big names, but other than that, it's guys sitting behind a table in Paris.
Yeah, there is something about magic that has led to a kind of cult of the amateur. So When we think about magic, maybe the first thing we think of is, you know, David Copperfield or David Blaine or something like that. But then we very quickly think of the uncle who or the grandfather who did magic tricks for us. So there's something really approachable about doing magic, and that's actually one of the things that led me to get into it. I thought, well, this is really interesting. This is a lot of fun. Why don't I learn some myself? And what I thought was going to be just a kind of idle everyday hobby in which I spend a little time now and then turned into an obsession pretty quickly.
Do you see this becoming a more studied thing, or is this just going to be, you know, one or two people will look into it, like yourself?
Well, I think that it's actually on its way to becoming more studied. So in addition to doing the philosophical work that I'm doing, I'm also beginning some collaborations with psychologists, such as Dr. Gustav Kuhn at Goldsmiths University of London, and he and some of his colleagues have begun to work on the question of the nature of the experience of magic, why it has the kind of power it has, and why we enjoy it. So I think that there's kind of a growing interest in exploring this question, and it overlaps really interestingly with other domains in psychology, such as the psychology of explanation. Why do human beings enjoy explaining things? It seems that we do. It seems that this is a part of the fabric of our being, and I think that that actually helps to explain why magic is so compelling for us, because it triggers our desire to explain something even while it prevents us from actually succeeding. So that, again, raises the question of why do we enjoy it?
Dr. Jason Ledington is a professor of philosophy in Bucknell University. You can read some of his writing on magic at jasonledington.com. It appears that if you like to read about something, you might also like to write about that. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
You write what you read. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Yella Lees Douglas, associate professor at the Center for Management Communication at the University of Florida, examines if reading more polished writing can make you a better writer.
Does what you read influence how you write? More than you may realize. Graduate student Samantha Miller and I recently studied the reading habits and writing styles of students in an MBA program. We asked students to record the sources they read most frequently in the past year. Then we captured a sample of students' writing from a required writing assignment. We then used software that analyzes sentence structure, together with software that scores writing based on the length of sentences and the sophistication of word choice. We discovered that students who read the New York Times, The Economist, Forbes, or the Wall Street Journal wrote with significantly greater sophistication than students who dedicated their time to reading Reddit, Tumblr, The Huffington Post, or BuzzFeed. Similarly, students who read nonfiction or academic articles wrote with greater sophistication than students who read mysteries or science fiction. However, the length of time our students spent reading had no impact on the sophistication of their writing. This outcome might reflect restrictions on students' free reading time while in an advanced degree program. On the other hand, the length of time reading might also be less significant for your writing than the quality of what you read. Our study might have uncovered the strength of syntactic priming, which is the way our writing sentence structure mimics the structure of sentences we read or hear. Or we might have discovered that the synchrony other researchers have discovered in conversation also applies to reading and writing. That discovery is that we unconsciously imitate the language we encounter most frequently. No matter what the cause, the takeaways are clear. Be careful what you read. What you read daily impacts how you write.
That was Yella Lees Douglas of the University of Florida. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.